yeah. Trying to make the world understand. Sharing all the love that we've got. Asking God to multiply it. Send it out to a one in need who doesn't believe in the price that was paid on Calvary's tree. Just set it for free.
Good evening and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. This evening, we're exploring memoir. My first guest is Gene Bialy. His book is I Remember Gospel and I Keep on Singing. In the second half of the broadcast, we'll hear from Linda Joy Myers, the author of Don't Call Me Mother, and Linda Loveland Reed from Redwood Writers. And then finally, Chuck Kensler will read from his memoir.
Separating the wheat from the tare. If you want perfect peace, my friend, you better give up. You know you better give in. Why don't you see? Why can't you believe? Why won't you receive? Why? Doing all the good we can.
Gene Bialy has a unique story. Gene is a white man singing black gospel music. Let's listen to Gene read from his book, I Remember Gospel.
I remember gospel when it was the center focus of my life. Life then was so easy. I was raised in a Pentecostal family where church, for us, was life. It seemed that we were in church more than anywhere else. And to be honest with you, I loved every minute of it. At about the age of 7, I remember Sundays were my favorite day. I awoke to the smell of chorizo, toast, brewing coffee or Mexican chocolate, boiling until the nata formed on the surface of the bubbling, boiling mix. Sunday, above all other days, was the day we as a family were together. We were united in faith and love. The house was filled with the sound of bathwater running. Mama would come in each room saying, "Come on, get up. It's time for a bath. Time to go to church. Mama, who's going to dress the baby? I'll do it if you want me to," my older sister Georgette would say. "Okay, but don't forget anything, huh?" Mama replies. So many times, 2 or 3 blocks from the house, one of us kids would exclaim, "Mama, Diane doesn't have her panties on again." Georgette wanted to be a mother even then, but she was just too young to be trusted to remember every little thing. Of the 4 of us, I guess the last one to get ready for the service was my older brother, Robert. I can't begin to tell you the ritual he had worked out for grooming. His hair had to be perfect, pomaded, with a curl in the middle of his forehead. Everything just so. Anyone who admits to being alive in the 50s could tell you that pomade, slicked hair, baggy pants, and buck shoes were in for boys. Ponytails, angora sweaters, poodle skirts, bobby socks, and white bucks were the dream for girls. Boy, they really thought they were cool. After all, this was the beginning of the rock and roll era. They were listening to worldly music, according to my folks. But for me, there was the collection of 78s that Mom still had from when they were living in sin, including Paul Whiteman, Carmen Miranda, and all the other Latin and big bands, with Hilo Hattie and a Hawaiian bands thrown in for good measure. No one knew what was about to envelop my little mind and change the sounds in our humble Visitation Valley home forever.
Why can't you believe?
That was Gene Bialy reading the beginning of his lovely memoir called I Remember Gospel and I Keep on Singing. It's a delight to have you in the studio today, Gene. One of the things that comes through so strongly in your book, Gene, is the importance of a loving family.
Oh, yes.
You didn't always have easy times, but your loving family just embraced you and most of the time supported you in your quest.
Yes, they did. Yeah. It's amazing to me, even now as we're going through the times that our country is experiencing. I look around and I see families not much different than the one I was raised in, pulling together. Do you see that, Rosemary, in our communities?
In hard times.
They're having to pull together in a way that we haven't seen probably since we were kids.
I think that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Your mother, you write about her as a first-generation Latin lady. I love that phrase. And you said she was afraid of nothing except that mouse.
Exactly.
Yeah, that mouse. That's a wonderful story that you tell about her fright at one little tiny mouse.
My mother could square off, I think, with anyone, you know, as far as an argument or trying to make a point. But the one thing that would send her up a wall, or as the book explains, cause her to sell our house,
oh, dear,
was a little field mouse.
Field mouse. You also said, my mother never spared her knees. I think that was such a beautiful way to paint the picture of the devoutness of your mother and her almost constant communication with God and her spiritual concern, not only for the family, but beyond the family.
Exactly.
Yeah.
She just had an uncanny relationship with the Lord.
Yes.
And Diane and I and the rest of the family were privy to watch as our lives bloomed and blossomed and we got older. And in times of crisis, that's where my mother would go.
Ah.
It was to her knees.
Mm-hmm.
And when things were going well, my mom still found time to hit those knees.
Yes.
It was just what you do.
Your father, his background was French and Italian. That's a volatile mixture.
It was.
And you say patience was not one of his virtues.
Exactly. My dad was a great guy.
Yeah.
And as I explained in the book, I really didn't realize the real depth of the man.
Yes.
Until just before he passed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, if you had him working on something and it wasn't working out quite right, that object he was working on could be broken rather than repaired quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
He had a quick temper and played it out. I remember on a car one time, it was amazing watching somebody take a hammer to a car because it just wasn't functioning the way he wanted it to function.
Whoa. You know? Whoa, that's pretty severe.
Yes, it was.
And his profession was a pattern maker.
Yes.
During the Second World War, he was an extremely valuable worker because of there were so few people who did what he did.
Exactly.
And yet the wages were frozen, and somehow his wages never got unfrozen, while other people in the profession seemed to progress through the ranks.
Well, what happened was all the pattern makers' wages were frozen because of the war effort.
Yes.
So that when they were unfrozen, they were always behind the other, jobs of that standing.
Mm-hmm.
So the pattern makers, though they were highly skilled, always made a little bit less than the plumbers, made less than, the other skilled workers in this country. So for some reason, that wasn't taken into account.
And as I read on through the book, I saw how many times there was a similar situation for you, that the music that you created and that you performed, because of the way the recording industry works, you often were not properly reimbursed. And what struck me was your lack of bitterness in this, that you simply didn't like it, but that was the way it was, and you moved on.
Well, gospel music for me was a calling.
Yes.
So early on, I had to learn, because of the fact that I was not an African American.
Yes.
And I was called, I felt, by God or by the higher power.
Yes.
To minister in that genre. And I chose to go ahead and do it as a calling. And when the money was good, it was a blessing. And when the money was poor, it was still a blessing. And when there was no money, it was still a blessing. And I believe that in over 50 years now that I've been ministering gospel music to predominantly African-American audiences, the reward has far passed and surpassed whatever would have come to me monetarily. God has been good.
That certainly comes through as you tell your story. And of course, it is such an unusual situation for a person who is not African-American to be called to sing that music. And of course, that's what makes your story unique. And I like the way that you lead into that. You were, of course, steeped in faith and music at home.
Yes.
And then for your 13th birthday, your family gives you the greatest present in the world. They take you to hear Mahalia Jackson.
They took me up to Nob Hill to hear and see the reigning queen of gospel music.
What a tremendous evening that was for you.
You know, the kids today say mind-blowing. It was mind-blowing.
Yes.
Mahalia, by that time, had embedded herself through her recorded music to the very depths and core of my being. I would listen to Mahalia's albums at home constantly. And so for my mom to say that I was actually going to see her was something unimaginable to me. And then to be driven up to the Masonic Temple on Nob Hill and walk into that majestic building.
Beautiful place.
To the tapping feet of people rushing in to get in on time. And then to sit up in the balcony and feel the spirit of expectancy that was in that auditorium. And then soon after that to see Mildred Falls come to the piano. And behind her, Eddie Robinson to the organ. And they began playing. They were playing music for the entrance of deity. And here came Mahalia, my idol. And then to see her go through one song after another and the electricity that would go through that building, we call it anointing.
Yes.
It would bathe the listeners to the point that you would hear weeping at times. This was almost a totally Caucasian audience.
Yes.
Downstairs.
Yes.
I was upstairs with
right.
the Latins and the Asians and the African Americans.
Right.
And I don't know if they felt the way I did, but I looked down and saw all these white folks down there weeping and clapping when the songs moved in rhythm and feet tapping. And then I looked around us and saw those of color doing the same thing. You know, that was one of my first lessons as to the effects that truth, she was singing out of her truth.
Yeah.
And to see that we were all being caught up by this magnificent, majestic presentation of simple gospel music. It overwhelmed me. I cried through almost the whole thing. And that's a memory that has never left.
Yes.
All these years later, mm-hmm. I remember Mahalia coming to that microphone.
You can still hear her.
I can still hear her. Mm-hmm. And her effect on me to this day is the same.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then, as though anything else wonderful could happen that evening, either your mom or your dad said, let's go across the street to the Fairmount Hotel and have dinner.
My mom was a nightclub entertainer before she was converted.
Oh.
And she had friends who were playing in the Tonga Room. But
yes.
She said, let's go over there and we're going to have dinner. And so we went to eat. And as we sat beside that big waterway that they have in the Tonga Room, in walked the Queen and her entourage. Well, my mother didn't notice it. I did. And she sat across the water from us. And when I told my mom and my cousin and lady friend of ours who was with us, who was sitting across, they said, well, go get her autograph.
Yes.
Rosemary, to this day, I don't know what I was thinking. But I found myself looking at my mom and saying, not until I can stand on her ground and she'll know who I am. And of course, the table I was sitting at broke up in laughter.
Yes.
When I was 22 years old, Rosemary, I went to hear Mahalia. I was a serviceman then.
Yes.
And she was playing at the Circle Star. And during the second part of her performance, Mahalia asked the people that were working the lights to bring the lights to search down the auditorium until they found the person. She was saying, "Baby, you stand up, baby. I want to speak to you." I met Mahalia standing at the Circle Star. She was on the stage. Her musicians had seen me come in and recognized me from photos of myself and the Cleveland Singers years before. And we met that night in front of that Circle Star audience. And that's where our friendship began.
Tell me about the Cleveland Singers.
Reverend James Cleveland was known at the time when I was working with him as the crown prince of gospel music. Reverend Cleveland traveled nationally and then internationally. He, at that time, had recorded a song called "Peace Be Still," which was considered one of the only 1 million-selling gospel records. He had the largest African-American audience of any other recording artist other than James Brown. And I was asked by him, again, another one of those God things. I was visiting family members in the Van Nuys area. Being Latin, you know, we're known for gardening and cleaning carpets and things like that. So as a kid in high school, my mom sent me down to work with my cousin and his family, and they had a gardening business. And this one day in particular, I had been handed over to Andre and Sandra Crouch, who are renowned worldwide for gospel music. They were just young people then, of course, and they were going to babysit me for the day, per se. And we went out for the day, and then they said, "We're not going to be able to get you home very early because we have to go pick up somebody. And we'd like you to come with us, and then we'll drop you off after, you know." So sure enough, we went and picked up a person whose records I had been buying. And James Cleveland was one of my favorites. So he got in the car, and we took him home.
Imagine.
Well, everybody thought that he had gone out to pick up some food for us because he said he was going in the back to change and everything in his home. And there was a bunch of musicians, like Billy Preston was one of them that was there. Edna Wright from the Honeycombs was there. I believe that's her group name. And they were all just comparing music and notes about songs. And Andre Crouch asked if I would sing a song. And so I went to the piano and Andre began to play. And lo and behold, out walked Reverend Cleveland.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, when I got through with the song and was starting to leave with Andre and his sister Sandra, Reverend Cleveland asked if I would consider being one of the James Cleveland Singers. Now, I was from a small church in San Francisco. My grandparents pastored there. We were lucky if we had 100 people at that period of time in a service. And here was the King of Gospel, whose average Sunday audience ranged from 5, 10, 20,000 people. I was 17 and a half. I had just graduated from high school. Well, long story short, week later, he asks permission from my parents. Now, you've got to read the book to find out what happens in the interim.
Oh, we don't give anything away in these interviews. No. People will read the book. Don't worry.
And when my parents give permission to go, our first audience, I believe, was a couple of thousand. Our second audience was 10,000. Our largest audience, while I was a Cleveland Singer, was 99,000 people. We would travel throughout the summer months, well up into winter, in a car with records under our feet and in the trunk. We had usually five or six people in the car. There was three of us and Reverend Cleveland and a manager. We would sleep in the car. We would eat in the car. Because we went to every nook and cranny of this country. I know what it's like to sing in front of audiences in grand cathedrals and auditoriums. But I also learned what it was like to go into these little backwater places where buildings were on stilts down south and where singers were called songsters.
Songsters?
See? I didn't hear that. And you'd be greeted at the beginning of a town and they'd say, y'all the songsters that are coming to sing tonight, you know? And they'd tell you where the best place was so you could get something to eat. Remember, this is in the 60s.
Yes, in the South. Yes.
So we could not sleep in the hotels in many cases, in most cases. We could not eat in the restaurants. We could not use the restrooms.
That's right.
Unless you went to the black one or the white one. Mm-hmm. And I was somewhere in between.
Right.
Because being Puerto Rican and Mexican on my mother's side, there is African there.
Yeah,
and
you,
I knew it.
But you might as well have been white.
Exactly.
All your audience knew. So you were the white guy in the black.
Yeah. But the only problem with it is in my psyche, I knew better than that.
That's right.
So to use the white bathrooms, I felt like I was forgetting who I really was.
Amazing.
It was quite hard, to say the least. But Reverend Cleveland became the king of gospel. So I was part of a group that birthed and was part of birthing black gospel as we know it today. We traveled together with the caravans, Shirley Caesar being one of them. I ended up singing at times with Mahalia duets. Can you imagine?
My goodness.
Can you imagine?
No.
Singing with the queen.
I can't imagine.
You know, with the Ward singers, Clara Ward singers, and the Staple singers, and the Mighty Clouds of Joy, and the Five Blind Boys. These were all people that I saw all the time.
Goodness gracious. Incredible.
Yes.
Would you tell the story of, I think it was when you were in the Army, and
yes.
you were going to be in a performance, and you started singing behind the curtain. Would you tell that story?
When I was at Fort Sam Houston, Texas, I was drafted out of the Cleveland Singers.
Yes.
It was during the Vietnam era. And even though I was given paperwork from the recording company I was signed to at the time to see if they could put me in special services, it was, given the fact that I was a gospel singer, thought to be fairly impossible. So they made me a medic. So I was sent to Fort Sam Houston. Everybody that can't do anything else, you're a medic, right?
Right.
And so I ended up at Fort Sam Houston, Texas, and they had a group there predominantly of non-combatants, I being one of them. And they were either Seventh-day Adventists or an array of other faiths.
Yeah.
It was apparent that some of the guys were really sort of feeling down. Because they didn't know how to relate to this,
of course.
You know, Army
right.
Experience.
Right.
And so they had announced that they were going to do a talent contest on bass.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we do? Okay, a group of us get together and say, okay, what are we going to do? Okay, let's do this. Let's do a gospel song.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. See? And one of the guys was a tremendous pianist. Another guy played sax and drums and... Mm-hmm. So, well, then you got to sing. Okay, I'll sing. So how are we going to stage this so not only will we sing, but we'll win? So the idea came up, how about I'll sing, go tell it on the mountain. But what we're going to do is keep the curtain closed until I get well into the song. Then you can open it up. And they sort of laughed.
Right.
They got it, but they didn't get it.
Right.
You have to remember, again, in the 60s, I was a tremendous oddity. The Righteous Brothers came really a little after me. There was no, quote-unquote, white folks singing black gospel.
No, you were the first.
Mm-hmm. And amongst black audiences. So I thought, okay, if I'm ever going to use it, we're going to use it now.
Right.
Okay, so I did. The night of the competition, when it came our turn, they announced my name. And there was some applause. And then I began singing, Go Tell It on a Mountain. which is sort of reminiscent of the way Mahalia would have sung it. It would be sort of like, go tell it on the mountain, over the hill, and everywhere. Go tell it on the mountain that Jesus Christ is born. So we started in like that. And then when we started in, a little bit more, then they opened the curtains. And then I saw all the judges with their mouths open, and the guys were all applauding and laughing and screaming, because, see, the word had gotten them out amongst my black brothers. They knew what was going to happen. But none of the white folks knew what was going to happen, see? And we won.
Of course you won. How could you not? What are you doing these days? Do you still tour?
I still do some singing. Last year was quite active. I was all over the place. Mm-hmm. This year, I don't have really much scheduled yet. Mm-hmm. Recently have been installed as one of the pastorate of a church called City of Refuge Ministries in San Francisco, California.
Oh, really?
And it's a twist because it is a United Church of Christ.
Yes.
Our church is really very Pentecostal in way of worship.
Yes, yes.
But it is radically inclusive in nature.
Yes.
And you might ask, well, what in the world is Jane up to now? So I am ministering weekly, so still very active.
Right, right. Good. Jane, it's been so good to have you in the studio today, but it's been wonderful to talk with you, Jane, about your life.
Thank you.
I encourage people to get a hold of this book. We've only touched on things in this book, and everyone should have the privilege of reading it for yourself, for the richness of the language and the variety of events in this man's life. The book is I Remember Gospel and I Keep on Singing by Minister Gene D. Vialli.
The book is available through any bookstore by order and any internet bookselling site, as well as at genevialli.com, which is my website. I do have some CDs available. One is called The Early Years by Gene Vialli. The other one is A Light to This World, and they're now available on my website as well as at cdbaby.com.
And thank you so much for giving us your time today.
Thank you, Rosemary.
We're going to take a short break. You've been listening to Gene Vialli. His book is I Remember Gospel and I Keep on Singing. When we come back, you'll hear Linda Joy Myers, PhD, whose book is Don't Call Me Mother, and Linda Loveland Reed from Redwood Writers. We'll also hear from Chuck Kensler, local vintner, and Native American writer. We'll be right back. From door to door, yes, I have. Lord, I know you know me. Come on and show me which way. And we're back. Linda Joy Myers, PhD, is a psychologist and memoirist. She feels it's important to have our stories heard. Linda Joy will be one of the judges for the memoir contest sponsored by Redwood Writers. Linda Loveland Reed, the president of Redwood Writers, will talk about the contest. Linda Joy and Linda joined Suzanne Lang in conversation.
Here in the studio with Linda Joy Myers, who is the author of The Power of Memoir and the founder and president of the National Association of Memoir Writers. Welcome, Linda Joy.
It's great to be here.
and Linda Loveland Reed, our listeners are familiar with. She is an author and a theater director, among other things, an artist all the way around, and president of the Redwood Writers. And together you're in the studio with me to talk about memoir, about why people write memoirs, what is the nature of memoir, and then an upcoming contest with the Redwood Writers. But why don't we first start talking about memoir? It seems to me at one point people wrote memoirs who were getting on in years and wanted to reflect a little bit about something great that happened in history or art or in their lives. And now it seems like you can be 17, you can be 70. Maybe tell us what a memoir is and why do people engage in that process?
Well, a memoir is a story of a person's own memories, which means that you don't have to have the official stamp of approval of a family member necessarily in order to explore what your memories are and the meaning that they have to you. And I think that what's happened in society is that we really want to peer behind the closed doors of everybody's houses and find out how other people live. So since Mary Carr and Tobias Wolff about 15 years ago, put their memoirs out about childhood, about their experiences, and then many, of course, after that. Something happened. I think people went, wow, there's a grassroots movement. What is the meaning of my life? And do I have the right to speak it and say it and write it? And so that's just building, and we keep reading them.
Well, I find memoir to be very cathartic. I had a very good friend who died, and I found myself about 2 weeks later up in the middle of the night just pounding away on my keys. And almost nonstop, I wrote something that was very moving and very truthful. And I think that it was a healing thing for me, and I think it is for a lot of people. And then, of course, the way that everyone can write now and everyone can get published in one way or another. And I think that that's made a difference, too. Mm-hmm. It's just easier to get your thoughts out there.
Maybe some people feel they have a lot to say, maybe have experienced an alcoholic parent or something in their lives that has marked them or changed them. But also, I imagine there are some people who don't think they have anything to say.
Well, think about, for instance, the diaries of pioneer women. Think about, you know, your own great-grandmother's diary. I mean, they just put out there what they did that day and what they had in their garden and maybe what they wore. I've done a lot of research also about the generations in my family and found out what kind of conveyances they took where and when and what did they cook for dinner. And what it does is it helps preserve history. I mean, actually, all of our stories are embedded in the history of where we came from. And just put the judge to bed for a while and just sit there and write and remember and look at old photographs and maybe do genealogical research on Ancestry.com or one of those places, and those stories will bubble up.
Of course, it can be threatening. Mm-hmm. My daughter told me, gosh, Mom, I'm writing a memoir. And I'm
uh-oh.
you know, because we mm-hmm. all have those sensitive, tough times in our lives. And when you start writing about it and those people who were experiencing that along with you, they're still here. And that can sometimes be difficult. Right, Joy?
Absolutely. And I'm really glad you brought that up because, you know, this is why people don't write also, is because they really want to protect family members. They want to protect those that they love, whether they're innocent or guilty, as judged by the writer. But what I tell people is write as if you're writing just for yourself all the way through your first draft. And don't show it to anybody except your writing group, because as helpful as friends and family members may want to be, they might rain on your parade a little bit when it comes to feeling free to write. So I hope your daughter keeps it private until she's got through her first draft. And
well, I hope that I've been encouraging, but I think there might have been a few times where I'm going, gulp.
Of course you would. Yes. And I know people who were the subject of memoirs who did feel exactly like you do. It's a really normal feeling. We feel exposed. And we feel exposed as the writer. We feel as exposed as the subject. And it's very tricky to write memoir. And therefore, if we really don't want to do that, I tell people that they can stand behind what I call the fictional wall, which protects both the innocent and the guilty.
What is that fictional wall?
Just write fiction.
I see.
Now, you're not totally protected because everybody and their neighbor's dog knows who everybody is. But you, I mean, look, where most fiction comes from is, you know, real stories.
Well, I think one of the things about memoir is the truth of it. Mm-hmm. We talk about fiction. When we write fiction, we say, is there truth in it? We want there to be truth in it, you know, informed by something we feel or have passion about or have experienced. And of course, with memoir, it's all about truth. And I think it makes it charged with a little extra bit of energy,
emotion, and fear. But it's all good because some of that adrenaline helps us really sit on the edge of our chair as we dig for the stories. And we do our very best as memoir writers to tell the truth and to tell it as best we can. But it's our truth. I mean, you and your daughter have different truths of the era, even if it's the same year, the same day, and the same moment.
That's right. I'm very aware of that, that we perceive the same incident with different feelings and different outcome even in our minds.
Well, you can always write your own memoir and have a set.
I thought what might be fun is to have a family where each member of the family, like let's say siblings, writes about the exact same thing. Yeah. And put that in a book. Be fun.
Great idea.
Well, you're touching on a lot of qualities here and how memoir differs from autobiography. And it sounds like part of that difference is how facts are inflected with our maybe emotional countenance or recounting of that event. And also that you brought up the whole thing of memoir being cathartic. Yet also, you're talking about it being almost a historical artifact for the future, that there's value, I'll say a spectrum of value from writing memoir.
Our memoirs that we write are a kind of legacy for others, and this is what the majority of people want to do. I mean, some people want to write. They don't necessarily want to be published by a big publisher. They want to write for their family, a great deal of them. And some of them, many people that I work with, I do workshops online and work with a lot of people with their memoir. Some of them really are working for the healing benefit of it. And by healing, it doesn't mean that there's something terribly wrong with you, but that you would have a new perspective perhaps on your past when you write it down. And we all know what it's like. We are writing and suddenly some other thing falls onto the page that we didn't expect. And we go, where did that come from? You know, that's the magic.
A lot of people write memoir because the reasons you said, but also to share. To simply get their feelings out there and to get a response and to have a sharing of an experience. And it's not only healing, but it's also educational. And it helps, as you said, Suzanne, for the future as well.
And I think that it adds to the feeling of community. This comes back to what you were first saying, Suzanne. You know, why are so many people doing this? I think we need to feel connected again with each other. And by being able to share our story and me find out about yours, you find out about mine, we feel closer. We feel more connected. And I think that's what's happening.
And sometimes I wonder if it is a need as we recognize that sometimes we are these individual people, yet we do have the same experience, ultimately. Linda Joy, I'm interested. You have written a book, The Power of Memoir, and you feel strongly about this. You have organized the National Association of Memoir Writers, so you're passionate about this.
Yes, I really am. And I tell people that I began learning about memoir in a feather bed next to my great grandmother during the summers of my childhood, where she would tell me the stories of her life in the 19th century, and I was completely amazed that she was like a human being walking around as a book of stories. I just think that's where it started. And the other thing, I'm also a therapist, and you know, we construct our identity through our memories and through our own reactions to them. And of course, the process of therapy is to tell stories and to share stories and then begin to change the story that you're telling yourself. And the same thing happens when we're writing a memoir. It changes us and we are transformed by it. And I love working with people because I just see all these amazing things happen. And it happened to me too. So I just like to spread the word.
And you mentioned earlier a website. Do you have some online resources that people might want to examine?
Yes, we have a lot of them at www.namw.org, which stands for the National Association of Memoir Writers. We have free audios. We have a newsletter that comes out once a month with writing prompts, as well as a lot of connections to what's going on, including the Redwood Writers and what's going on here.
Perfect segue. Linda, tell us about what's going on.
Well, we're having another contest. We have lots of them, and we're very excited about this one. The deadline and the date to remember is June 15th, and this contest is for memoir, and it is open to anyone who lives in Sonoma, Napa, Mendocino, Marin, Lake, or Solano counties. And you do not have to be a member of Redwood Writers. And so June 15th, get that memoir in. 2,000 words is the maximum. And you can find all the information on our website at www.redwoodwriters.org. And I also want to say that not only are we absolutely thrilled and honored to have Linda Joy Myers be one of our judges, but we also have Susan Bono, who is the publisher of Tiny Lights here in our area. And then we have Amber Lee Starfire, who's publisher and editor of Writing Through Life and the Writer's Eye magazine. So we have some good people, and get those submissions in. Sit down and start writing. Also, we do have awards, $100 for the winner. And then there's also some financial awards for second and third place as well.
Now, some of you probably already have something going on and maybe just need to edit it. But some of you maybe don't know where to start. Where does somebody start?
Well, in my book and in all my articles, I talk about something called turning points, and that you choose an important turning point in your life that's very powerful to you and write about that. That's a really good place to start, because, of course, a memoir is just a little slice of your life. And the other bit of tip I would give is do your best to weave the narrative. This is what happened to me with a scene where we taste, smell, hear the sounds and feel of you inside that story, inside that setting. And that makes it very powerful.
Well, you know, Suzanne, you were saying, you know, people, maybe they don't think they have anything to write about. And actually, we do, each one of us, our lives are a drama every day. It might be walking out to get the mail and what you see along the way and how you feel about what you see and what it makes you reflect on. There are so many things each one of us have as human beings. We're complex, interesting people.
I agree.
Then I'm going to encourage all of the complex, interesting people out there to give this a try and to submit something. And what I have discovered about the Redwood Writers is that you're a very strong, supportive group for people who are new writers or seasoned writers as well. Give that website again, Linda.
Yes, it's www.redwoodwriters.org. And we meet the second Sunday of every month at the Flamingo at 2:30. And we have 244 local members. So we're very strong. It's the place to be for writers.
And the deadline for the contest?
June 15. And it does not have to be 2,000 words, right? That's just the maximum. So don't be afraid.
Well, the theme song for the National Association of Memoir Writers is Be Brave, Write Your Story.
I like that. Be brave, write your story. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
That was Linda Joy Myers and Linda Loveland Reed. For more information on the memoir contest, go to the website, redwoodwriters.org. Chuck Kensler has been a guest on this show discussing a memoir, Choteau Creek. And now we have the pleasure of hearing him read from his own work.
This is called 1940 Roads to Toppenish. In 1940, we traded one Indian reservation for another. Dad loves the Dakotas, but not all the leftover dust. He said the buffalo grass got turned under, the topsoil got turned wrong side up, and the land got over-farmed. There was no rain and the dirt blew into a giant dust bowl. Hot winds burned like prairie fires, and grasshoppers came clicking and whirling in black clouds. Hoppers were blown into dead piles like last year's haystacks. Slick grasshopper roads and trains slid off their tracks. The earth turned dry as powder and cracks disappeared. Empty buildings, deserted towns, flying dirt blowing out the sun. Broken shacks leaning against each other. Some lay in sideways piles. Dad said sodbuster folks got together right out in the fields, men and women alike. They cut up fresh lemons, rinds and all, into watery sand-sized pieces, stirred in mash and some white powder called arsenic. Then they spread the god-awful stuff on their fields. Still the grasshoppers kept coming. Crickets got in on the act, too. They kept coming, but pretty soon all the hoppers and the crickets died. The land died, too. My favorite story that Dad tells is about how grasshoppers chewed up every blade of depression grass, tree leaves, wheat stalks, and farmers' gardens, until the land grew nothing. Everything was gone. And then the grasshoppers crunched the fence posts until there was nothing left except loops of tangled barbed wire and tumbleweeds. And stickery grasshopper legs would snag onto your clothes tighter than a cockle burr. Dad always talks about the Great Depression, like when he says, "It's bad enough to make a hard man humble." And he says, "America in some hungry years." But it doesn't bother Indians as much as white people because Indians have always been hungry. Now Indians see pitiful white children with bloated bellies. What a shame. It's troubling that no one knows how much they've lost until they don't have it. Indians have no bread lines or shanty towns because we're too poor to have a depression. But think about it. How can you lose something if you've never really had it? Another time I heard Dad talking to Eddie Whiteweasel, who's a poor buckskin with pus in one eye. Dad tells Eddie, "The president's going to give the Americans a new deal for the forgotten man. But we're the forgotten ones, Eddie, and he forgot that he forgot us. He's got a plan to help us with all them alphabet agencies like the CCC and the WPA. Hell, even the president's got an alphabet name, FDR. And the BIA is one of those alphabet soup words. The BIA is a pile of horse crap run by boondogglers who tell Indians how to live. They're white people who specialize in red tape. Why aren't Indians part of the BIA? What a bunch of bunk that Bureau of Indian Affairs is. Dad knows a lot about Indians and alphabets." "It's time to leave," Dad says. "Who the hell wants to live in this godforsaken place? One day it's so hot piss will dry up before it hits the ground, and the next day it's so cold you've got to get in a hurry. It's hard to keep your roots in a land that's as dry as a tumbleweed." That's how it all got started. I was going on 6 years old in 1940 when we traded one Indian reservation for another. It takes 2 days to load all of our belongings into a two-wheel trailer that Dad and two of his friends built at the Indian Agency in Fort Yates. Dad tells Mom it's going to be tough to leave Roy Leith and Tony Turns His Head, Dad's friends since they were belly high to a short horse at an Indian boarding school called Haskell. Dad is going to send for them as soon as we get settled in and better fixed. They tie down everything we own under a canvas tarp, trailer hitch it to the back of our blue Chevy, and we're ready to head toward Toppenish, a green place in Washington. Mom and Dad talk about leaving tomorrow morning at some ungodly hour. I can't tell time yet, but I know ungodly means it's dark when the moon and the stars are out, and ungodly hour is when we're yawning and little brother Craig is still asleep. It's the hour when we slam the car doors and head into the night. Moon of Making Fat. We get going before the first crow gets up to take a leak. Now that's early because crows take their leaks before the sun comes up. Dad knows a lot about crows. He says when they turn their heads, their black eyes flash like lightning and their flapping wings make shaking thunder. It's yakin hauntin in Sioux talk. Lightning gives birth to sound. And he says crows say caw, not caw-caw, because that's something else. Dad looks at Mom and says, "You know, Scotty, all we have to do is follow this road to where the sun sets. I figure when we get there, we'll turn the corner to begin a better life, and we'll get enough muzzaska to pay for grub and gas, too. Chevy runs good, shouldn't have any problem. Change the oil, and it's got new plugs. Gap them myself." Mom smiles and pats Dad's shoulder. We head west. Our car lights pick up a coyote's yellow eye shine that looks as if its eyes are floating above clumps of bunch grass. Coyotes can do that, pop out their eyeballs so they bop around like lost eyes. Coyotes are a kind of wild dog who can change into other animals, and they're slick talkers who live in scattered places. They're powerful because the next time you see them, they might show up as a trickster or a medicine wolf. Dad knows a lot about coyotes. Farther on, over a few humps and bumps, an owl turns its head toward us, steps off a Burma Shave sign, and swoops across the gravel road. We pretend we don't see the big-eyed wing flapper. In our family, we don't look or talk about owls because they're a warning that someone's going to have bad luck or get their toes turned up. Still, I wonder why people say owls can turn their heads around like their necks on a spinning top. It's quiet, all except for the tires kicking up gravel and the sounds of it hitting the underside of our car. Ping, ding, ding. I look out the window. It's still dark. I wonder how far it is to Toppenish. I hope it's not as far as Montana, because when we went there to see my grandmother and grandfather and my mom's sisters, we drove all day. "Hey, Dad, how long does it take to get to Washington?" "Damn it, Sonny, can't you remember anything? It's a long trip. Maybe 3-4 days. We have to drive through a corner of North Dakota, then Montana, Idaho. Toppenish is about halfway across Washington. I'll tell you when we get there." All I remember is we're pulling up stakes because Dad got a transfer to work on the Yakima Indian Reservation where they need surveyors. Ping, ding, ding, pa-doing. There's too many gravel noises to count because I can only count to 10 or 13 or 12. Dad strikes a match and takes a long drag on his cigarette. The end of the cigarette glows red, and he takes another puff. Smoke curls into the back seat like ribbons blowing in the wind. It's still dark except for the dashboard lights. "Scotty, look over there, above that ridge. Might be our last moon in the Dakotas." "Huh? What?" "The moon, the ridge." Dad looks over the top of his glasses and points straight ahead. "I was drifting a bit. Well, I never. 'Tis the biggest moon I be seeing." Mom puts her hand on the dashboard and leans forward to get a better look. "Indians say Hanwe, the moon of making fat. This moon shows up when the sun's highest in the sky, when it has the power to make things grow strong and fat. See how Hanwe hangs full belly as if it's eaten too much? Watch as it grows fatter and hangs like a gunny sack full of Juneberries, ready to drop." "What you be saying, Juneberries?" Mom asked. "Probably don't grow in Scotland, along the bottomlands out here. Bushes with gray bark, follow cricks, white flowers. Spring leaves turn from kind of purple to deep green, then yellow and red in the fall." Dad puffs on his smoke and says, "The berries are nearly red-black when ripe." He blows a stream of smoke against the windshield and checks his rearview mirror. "There are people who say the berries are sweet as blueberries, but beats the hell out of me. Never tasted a blueberry. Our women folk bend the berry limbs down and clean pick them in a few days before they're ripe, before the birds strip the fruit." Dad picks a piece of tobacco off his lip, rubs it between his fingers, and flicks it onto the floor. "Mother Earth gives to us in one way or the other. If the birds get the berries first, then the Indians get first dibs on the fat berry birds." Dad takes another puff. Dad knows a lot about berries and birds. "Scotty, did I tell you the story about how Buffalo showed the Skew how to make a sweat lodge with sticks, stones, fire, and some water?" "What's that you be saying? You carrying on about Indians again?" "Never mind, just talking to myself. But, you know, on second thought, it was the coyote doing the teaching about the sweat lodge, not the buffalo. The sun will be up soon. I watched Dad's black hair and Mom's mousy brown curls from behind the back seat perch. We have our bedding and pillows piled nearly to the bottom of the back windows. They're stacked high enough to let me look out the windows just like grown-ups do. Little brother Craig doesn't do much because he hardly walks or talks, so he mostly sleeps or stares at the headliner or cries to have his diaper changed. Our headlights flash on mile after mile of shiny strings of wire strung from telephone pole to telephone pole on their straight-out arms. Dad calls them talking wires. The wires ripple like water in the moonlight. I wonder if our old reservation is tied to our new reservation with wires stretched as tight as a clothesline rope. I watch the numbers on the speedometer. The radio's red dial is tuned to a singing cowboy. Then Dad says, "You can tune a radio, but you can't tune a fish." He glances at Mom. She hardly smiles and shakes her head. Dad must think it's funny because he smiles and pushes her shoulder with his finger. I'm sleepy. I can hardly hear Dad. "You know, Scotty, it's going to be hard for a while, but we'll get better. Hell is better as soon as I got the transfer. Better pay, make more money, make it worth it. Better shakes than the Okies got. Damn government gave up on them just like they did the Indians. Poor bastards worked all day for a cup of flour and a dab of lard. Not even good lard. But them Okies were tough and they knew how to keep themselves together by picking songs on a washboard, banjos and harmonicas. They fought the hardships, nature and government, with plain old guts. Good people, them Okies." The car radio makes a fuzzy sound and Mom says, "'Tis a good move, Emery. We'll be doing just fine. We're young. We'll find a house when we get to Toppenish. You're smart. You have a job, and you're tougher than any person from Oklahoma. Yeah, but you don't know any Okies."
Isn't it great to hear Chuck Kensler reading his own story? I'm sure you remember Kathleen Berry, who was on the show recently talking about her book, Unmaking War, Remaking Men, How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. Kathleen will be speaking in conversation with Norman Solomon at the Sebastopol Community Church on Tuesday evening, May 17th at 7. Copperfields will be on hand with books by both authors, who will be glad to sign their books for you. Sebastopol Community Church is at 1000 Gravenstein Highway North, and admission is free. All are welcome. And that's our program for tonight. I hope you enjoyed our collection this evening. Every memoir is different. Thanks to our guests this evening, and to Suzanne Lang, who produces the show. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.